enemies, not just against its neighbors, but across the region and even the rest of the world. And more importantly, whether or not that support is undergoing any shifts today. Thank you for watching We the People.
As a young girl visiting Palestine to see my grandparents and extended family, I watched as my mother had to go to dehumanizing checkpoints. I remember shaking with fear when checkpoints appeared in the small village of Beth Orel Foka. Tanks and guns everywhere.
Washington's closeness to Tel Aviv has helped strengthen the U.S. presence in the West Asian region. The United States has stored military equipment in Israel since the early 1990s. Yet the unbreakable bond between Israel and the U.S. runs deeper than military aids and treaties.
Anyone who wants to contribute to the cause, anyone who wants to provide funds or any other kind of help is welcome. We love our friends, and we don't see why some people should feel uneasy about taking assistance or money from this or that friend.
The so-called State of Israel was established by the Israeli Declaration of Independence on 14th of May 1948. Israel was officially declared a state, setting off on a path to brutality towards the occupied lands, neighboring countries, and beyond. Today, Tel Aviv's atrocities have been acknowledged by almost every state in the world. Our first guest is Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi, a senior scholar and the director of Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. Dr. Abdulhadi, first of all, how do you evaluate the U.S.-Israel relations throughout history and the unwavering support Washington has offered to Tel Aviv?
Historically, the United States has supported Israel. Since actually the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948, more successive U.S. administrations have increased support as they went along until the latest president, Trump, has actually not only supported Israel but went along unconditionally with every aspect of its colonialist, racist, and apartheid policies. So this has been going on, and it has gotten to a very alarming situation right now.
Many thanks for your insight, Dr. Abdulhadi.
The U.S. support for Israel does not only involve the U.S. government itself. A glance at the history of the West's support for the Israeli regime shows that the number of Christian evangelicals backing the Zionist agenda stands way above the actual Jews. Christian Zionism is a phenomenon of the past and the present, a false ancient obsession that still today gets to play a significant role in world politics, particularly inside establishments of superpowers such as the United Kingdom and the United States.
Christians have directly brought over 750,000 Jews to Israel. That it started with the Soviet or the Russian Jews. It continued with Ethiopian Jews, where we brought most of the Ethiopians. It continued with some of these lost tribes of B'nai Menashe from India. But today, we bring from 28 countries.
But making Jews go to lands that belong to Palestinians comes with a high cost for humanity. How can the Christian Zionists' ancient prophecies and their combination with power in Washington be justified, considering its impact on the reality of people's lives today? Abbas Hamida is with us to discuss that. He's a Palestinian activist and commentator. He's also the co-founder of Al-Awda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition. Hello and welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Mr. Hamida, what is on the evangelicals' agenda?
The Christian Zionists have an agenda, you know, in occupied Palestine, more so probably than the Jewish Zionists. I mean, in my opinion, they're just being used. So they have that same colonial settler mentality where we see in Palestine, for example, Jews coming from anywhere around the world, in particular Europe, they come and build these illegal outposts, okay? They build these houses on the mountaintops right across the street from the Palestinian people. You know, these people are extremely delusioned. They believe in a fanatical style, an ISIS style, if you will, of religion.
Thanks for your insights. Stay with us.
Evangelicals began cultivating ties with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu during his first stint as prime minister in the 1990s. Today, the Israeli premier is the evangelicals' rock star. But not all Israelis have that sense of trendline in the U.S. Instead, some fear the Christian Zionists' true missionary agenda, converting them.
I believe that evangelicals support Israel because they connect Israel to their faith. Their Bible is a Jewish Bible. Their Messiah is a Jewish Messiah. And it's a connection. It's a DNA that goes back to Sunday school and to their very being. It's a love affair. It's a romance with a nation that is connected to heaven and earth.
That has made Israelis, even those residing on illegal settlements, view evangelists as a threat to Jews, though the Christians may have just been dispatched to help them harvest grapes at their vineyards on the occupied Palestinian territories. So, how is the love-hate relationship going?
Christian Zionists are very much committed to the preservation of Israeli colonialism, racism, and apartheid, because they actually also have this belief that if they bring about the power of Israel, Israel is going to fall apart, and by the Israel's falling apart, that's going to bring up the Messiah. So actually they are interested, they are engaged and invested in the destruction of the Jewish people, if you will, inside Israel. The Zionists, the Jewish Zionist lobby, and non-Jewish, because it is not only Jews, and there are many, many Jews, growing number of Jews, who stand on the side of justice in for Palestine and join hand in hand with Palestinians in the struggle for justice for all, and also refuse to allow Israel to speak in their name. They don't want to be complicit in the crimes of Israel against the Palestinians.
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is another powerful entity pressuring Washington to pursue Israeli interests. Since money is what fuels American support for Israel, the pro-Israel lobbying behemoth has too much sway over American policy.
To advocate, to affect policy, for the security of the Jewish state, for the benefit of the United States, for today, for tomorrow, forever. We are AIPAC, proud pro-Israel Americans, bringing Democrats and Republicans together, citizen activists, strengthening two great nations, moving America and Israel forward together. AIPAC, America's pro-Israel lobby.
Founded more than 50 years ago to strengthen, protect, and promote the U.S.-Israel relationship, the Israeli lobby in the U.S. also makes sure that dissenting voices are not allowed to be heard by being branded as anti-Semitic. With the organization's strong encouragement, AIPAC's members keep endorsing or raising money to influence U.S. politics in favor of Israel. So what is AIPAC after in the U.S. political system?
AIPAC lobby in Washington, D.C., that continues to basically support the idea that Israel is somehow an ally to the United States because they share the same values, because it's a Judeo-Christian society. And as we know, that's all hogwash. Their main interest is, the United States' main interest is basically to have hegemony in the region and to dominate and to have their military powers inside the Middle East, you know, inside occupied Palestine. This way, it's part of their global domination period.
The main victims of Israel's vicious actions are indeed Palestinians. Decades of systematic crackdown by the occupying forces have taught Palestinian generations that resistance remains the sole method to nullify the regime's inhumane tactics.
Daily life under occupation has yielded a whole lot of troubles for the Palestinian people, which they have to deal with on a daily basis, while their sufferings are underreported. Many activists assert that it is time to pay more attention to resistance against the occupation of Palestine if the world is actually serious about ending the Israeli aggression in the region. Is there no two-state solution then?
Palestinians do not necessarily support what is called the two-state solution, nor is the two-state solution viable. It's not even viable. I mean, even if you want to say this is what you want, There isn't, it doesn't really work. Israel has continued to take on more land and Ethiopia. The other thing is that I think it's really important to understand that Palestinians as a colonized, marginalized, oppressed people should not have to have the responsibility to find solutions for the colonial power that's oppressing them. So on all counts, this is not what Palestinians want. This has been, Israel actually has consistently destroyed any possibilities. The United States has supported Israel.
One of the most brutal and obviously illegal actions that Israel has been taking is the construction of settlements in Palestinian lands. Thousands of Israelis live in settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. This is while all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law as they're built on occupied land.
We have a terrorist haven that is getting more and more rockets shipped in from Iran and elsewhere.
Nick, what are your thoughts on how that played out during
the... Well, that exchange, the full Israel-Palestinian exchange is, I thought, by far the most interesting moment of the debate. They actually, it calmed down. They sort of talked to each other a little bit more. And Bernie Sanders laid out pretty clearly a position I have not seen any politician lay out on national stage ever, which is to say, look, there is a conflict, and really our sympathies have to be a heck of a lot more with the Palestinians.
The international community has repeatedly opposed Israel's settlement activities, urging U.S. President Biden to put pressure on Israel over the issue. In the meanwhile, Israel keeps approving plans for more settler homes. Is it wishful thinking to somehow expect U.S. policymakers to make a positive change?
I mean, we would like to see change through Congress in the United States. We would like to see, mainstream politics go ahead and leaders getting involved. We would love that. We would love for there to be a real workable solution where the refugees can come back under UN Resolution 194, which grants the Palestinian refugees all around the world the right to return to their homes. Okay, that's my main activism here in the United States, is to push for that. But in all reality, what I see is that this illegal Zionist entity is heading towards self-destruction. Unfortunately, they venture and some of these maneuvers that will one day, end the Zionist program in Palestine.
Many in the United States question the levels of aid and general commitment to Israel. But those behind the curtain feel confident that the U.S. relations with Israel strengthen the U.S. presence in West Asia. But according to some polls, the nation is relatively divided about Washington's policies towards Tel Aviv.
They do not believe that there should be a constant incitement by Hamas, aided and abetted by Iran, against Israel.
I don't think that anybody would suggest that Israel invites or welcomes missiles flying into their country. That is not the issue. And you evaded the answer. You evaded the question. The question is not does Israel have a right to respond, not does Israel have a right to go after terrorists and destroy terrorism. That's not the debate. Was their response disproportionate? I believe that it was. You have not answered that.
Israel is more popular among older Americans, Republicans, conservatives, and evangelicals, and less popular among liberals, African Americans, and Democrats. Regardless of its public image in the US, Israel has an immense economic power with more companies listed on the NASDAQ than any other country outside North America. Is it any different with Democrats in power today?
I think the only way the new President Biden's administration is as far as occupied Palestine goes is lip service. The Democrats are better at deceiving the world. They're better at deceiving their own citizens by offering lip service about Palestine. Saying we want to get back to the table, we want to do this, and we want to. So, in other words, getting back to the table is still the same situation. It's still the same policy, because going back to the table is just delaying time. For the Palestinian people, there's an occupation that needs to end. The settlements must be dismantled. There's a long list of Palestinian refugees, languishing all over the world, over 7.2 internally and externally million Palestinians, 7.2 million, who wish to go back to their original towns and homelands in Palestine. I happen to be one of them in the United States.
The Zionist regime was emboldened to new highs during the administration of former President Trump. The billionaire businessman who was controlled in part by the Christian Zionists and the Jewish lobby in America served Tel Aviv like no U.S. presidents before him. He moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem al-Quds, a holy city that Palestinians consider the capital of their future state.
It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Israel is a sovereign nation with the right, like every other sovereign nation, to determine its own capital. It was 70 years ago that the United States, under President Truman, recognized the State of Israel. Ever since then, Israel has made its capital in the city of Jerusalem.
Unlike former presidents, Trump recognized the city as the Israeli capital, despite international outcry. The U.S. moved on and officially recognized Syria's Golan Heights to the regime's territory as well, although it had already been occupied for many years.
The United States is an interventionist power. The United States is very much interested in continuing to be intervening in the region. In that sense, Israel actually is quite the relationship with Israel. And I wouldn't say that the United States is sort of like the Israel is not only a base for the U.S., Israel is a junior partner. They both want to control the oil of the region. They want to control the region, which is a very strategic place. They want to be able to suppress any kind of possibilities for movements. They already participated both in Arab regimes' support for the counter-revolutions in the Arab world.
Many thanks. Stay with us as we have more for you.
The administration under President Joe Biden has pledged to change course in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. During his 2020 presidential election campaign, Biden reiterated his proclivity for a so-called two-state solution. The U.S.-Israel relations have also been at odds, at least on the surface, over the Biden administration's stated efforts to return Washington to the Iran nuclear deal, which Trump quit.
Remember here, Biden is very pro-Israel. I don't think that we can, you know, sugarcoat the reality that although there was a very tense relationship between Netanyahu and Obama, Biden has always had a very good relationship with the Israelis and with Netanyahu, generally speaking. That's not going to be reversed. And frankly, I'm sure there may be some elements of the progressive party of the Democrats who want to see that reversed. But the majority of the Senate will be Republican, and I think there's just no appetite to do something like reversing the embassy decision. On the JCPOA, I think there is definitely going to be an interest to go back to some sort of multilateral negotiations, which the JCPOA was. The challenge, of course, is that the world isn't the same as it was when it was negotiated in 2015.
In reality, Biden is being similarly controlled by the regime's powerful lobbies pursuing the Zionist agenda inside the United States. The pro-Israel U.S. media at times portrays Biden's relations with Israel as less cozy compared to previous American leaders. But his administration intends to build on some of Trump's one-sided policies in the region. Unlike Barack Obama and Donald Trump, Biden has not named a special envoy to focus on the Israeli-Palestinian portfolio.
Hundreds of delegates to the Democratic National Convention have asked Biden to get rid of a few pro-Israeli strategic people on his staff for his campaign, and Blinken was one of them. So that's one thing. The secondly is that Biden has also said that they're going to continue the same U.S. policy towards Israel by centering what they call Israeli security without actually giving any attention to Palestinian security, Palestinian safety. Palestinians are the ones who are occupied, who are colonized, who are displaced, who are uprooted. They are the ones who need security. It's not Israel who's like, what, the fourth or the fifth strongest army in the world. It doesn't really need that. Israel presents the argument for security in order to deflect from the real issues at stake, which is Israel's racism, colonialism, occupation, the displacement of Palestinians, the refusal to allow Palestinians to return. So now the United States government says that this is what they support. As far as these are one of the main anchors of their policy towards Israel, they have restored some of the things that Trump taken away. So they restored U.S. funding towards UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Work Agency.
Biden has so far adopted a passive role in dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unlike most of his recent predecessors. He has no plans for any sort of peace conference or even a peace process anytime soon. Yet, his initial resistance in engaging with the issue could eventually change, making him unable to totally ignore it.
Look, you're all united. We're all united by our unyielding, and I mean it literally, unyielding commitment to the survival, security, and success of the Jewish state of Israel. But what impresses me most is what I know those of you who've been with AIPAC a long while understand is the lifeblood and the certainty and security. And that is the more than 4,000 young people you have here. Would all the young people who are here stand up if it's your first? I want to see.
That was the former vice president. With Biden in the White House again, Trump's heavily pro-Israel tilt has been replaced with reluctance to wade into the conflict for now.
Even if the U.S. shows more interest in dealing with conflict, Palestinians have already lost their hope and trust in the United States' baseless claims of pursuing peace. It is therefore unlikely for the U.S. to change course in regards to Israel and its atrocities. I'm your host, Mila Jawamadi.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How
much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. We are currently in the holy month of Ramadan, and hopefully we are making good use of it. In one of our previous episodes, we discussed a particular book that dealt with the etiquettes of the holy month of Ramadan. In this segment as well, we will be introducing another very beautiful book that deals with the etiquettes and with the means by which a person can achieve the objective of this holy month. The objectives of this holy month are many. But there are two main objectives. One is that a person should strive for two things. One, which is the most important, is that he needs to get proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is the most important. But in order for a person to do so, as the example that is given, in order for a person to fly, he needs to shed all that excess baggage. And how is that done? By repentance. By getting his sins forgiven, and more importantly, by enabling himself to attain and to acquire the concept of self-restraint. That when a sin comes in front of him, he is able to remove himself from that particular environment. Rather, he is able to remove himself from that particular instant where he is able to sin. Even if he is put into an environment where sinning is easy, quote-unquote, it doesn't affect him, because he has such self-restraint and has trained his soul to such an extent, especially in this holy month. That is one of the principles of fasting, is that when we are refraining from doing something halal, such as eating and drinking, or something permitted and necessary, it should then enable us to rather refrain from that which is haram and forbidden. This is the training and the development that should take place in this blessed month. So hopefully, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be introducing a very beautiful book by a very esteemed and great scholar, inshallah, to our dear brothers and sisters. Please stay tuned. Till then.
We turn to you day and night, seeking ways from wrong to right. We turn to you in prayer and love, not knowing all the deeds we do. We turn to your endless favors, increasing in their flavors. We turn to you in sheer delight, for truth never strong to fight.
Welcome back to our program, Bookshelf, on IRIB English Radio, in this blessed month of Ramadan. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters and our dear listeners, as I mentioned in our previous segment, in order to make our fasting and our this act a divine act. The book is called Fast. This is just the title of the book. And it has been written by one of the great contemporary scholars, one of the great contemporary jurists of our time, Sayyid Abul Qasim Al-Khu'i, rahmatullah alayh, the great sage and scholar who was the, you know, za'im and the protector, and if you want to call it, the head of the Hawza of Najaf for a very long period of time. This book has been published by Tablighat-e-Imani. And unfortunately, as we all know, that said Abul Qasim Al-Khu'i didn't know English. Right? This is obvious. He never knew English. He knew Farsi, he knew Arabic. He may have known Urdu, Allahu A'lam. But the book obviously is in English. Unfortunately, the translator of the book is not written, and it was very difficult to be found. Rather, I did not find it at all. The book is small, yet it is very comprehensive. It contains great gems, you know, great profound teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that will assist a person in furthering and attaining knowledge about what he or she should do in this blessed month. So the book begins with a dedication and then is followed by six chapters. Those six chapters namely are the fruits of fasting for the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the significance of Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr, a unique festival, time of joy for Muslims. The ideal of Islamic charity is the fourth one. The fifth one is Eid al-Fitr, serves three purposes. And the sixth chapter and the last chapter is important rules of Sharia concerning fasting and prayer of the two Eids. Now, unfortunately, I had to add to because the translation was not very good. The translation reads like this. Important rules of Sharia concern fast and prayer of Eidain. Now, Eidain basically means Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha. So hopefully, inshallah, we can make use of this book, and hopefully in our next segment, we'll be able to quote for our dear listeners a short and hopefully profound segment from this book. Inshallah, please stay tuned.
Love is everywhere. So much peace fills up the air. Ramadan, month of the Quran. I feel it inside me, strengthening my iman. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan. Ramadan, ya Habib, Ramadan, Ramadan.
Welcome back, my dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. And we have been discussing the book Fast by the great scholar, the great Marja Taqlid, or the grand authority of the Shi'i school of thought, Ayatollah Al-Uthma Sayyid Abu al-Qasim Al-Khoi Rahmatullah Alayh. As I mentioned, it's a very small book, and in this book, the first chapter, or one of the first chapters, is concerning the fruits of fasting for the servants of Allah. That is, what does a servant gain or can gain from the fast in this blessed month? So the great Sayyid writes, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the merciful. The philosophy of fasting is well known. It gives the servants of Allah a training in discipline, self-control, unquestioned obedience to God. It cultivates self-denial in man so that he may be able to understand the problems facing the community and society. Islam is a religion, compact and well-balanced. It is not just a collection of some unrelated ideologies and traditions. There is a good reason behind every enjoyment, every tenet, and every precept. So compact is the whole Islamic system, in fact, that you cannot believe in it piecemeal. Basically, you cannot believe in it one part and not believe in another part. You have either to take it in its entirety or leave it in total. You cannot select from it. Take, for example, the lunar system of the Islamic calendar. Though Islam recognizes the solar year for the purpose of zakat and khums, it insists on following the lunar system in other matters, like fasting and the pilgrimage. Why this double standard? Again, this translation is not correct. Double standard, this doesn't mean this here. It just means, why is this different standards and criteria? The reason is simple enough. Islam is a universal religion, and the fast and pilgrimage are intended for the whole of mankind. We are saying for the whole mankind, wherever they may be living. And the fact is, one cannot pinpoint a single minute in a whole year which is equally convenient for the whole world. Inshallah, my dear brothers and sisters, until our next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States imports more crude from Canada than any other country at about 3.7 million barrels per day, nearly 80% of Canada's crude output. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Nia Williams, David Liugren, and Laura Sanicola, entitled Frustrated Canada Presses White House to Keep Great Lakes Oil Pipeline Open. The article was published by the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us. An ongoing dispute over a cross-border oil pipeline between Canada and the United States is escalating as Ottawa is pushing on several diplomatic fronts against the U.S. state of Michigan's efforts to close it. Michigan officials, citing environmental concerns, have called for the closure of Line 5 pipeline, which carries over 500,000 barrels of oil and natural gas liquids each day from Superior, Whiz, to Sarnia, Ontario. The 645-mile pipeline, which is part of the Calgary-based Unbridge Incorporation's main line system, feeds refineries in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Ontario, and Quebec. The imbroglio is indicative of the disruptions caused by a global shift away from fossil fuels. However, both governments are attempting to speed up the energy transition. Their oil industries are interdependent, so a policy shift in one can impact energy supply and the political balance in the other. The United States imports more crude from Canada than any other country at about 3.7 million barrels per day, nearly 80% of Canada's crude output. Four sources familiar with the government thinking told Reuters that Canada's strategy is to repeatedly bring up the issue of Unbridge Line 5 with different U.S. counterparts, including U.S. President Joe Biden, in order to get them to prevent Michigan's Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer from closing the pipeline. Last November, Michigan ordered Line 5 to shut by May 13, citing a risk to the environment over a possible leak in the 4-mile stretch of 540,000 BPD line passing under the Straits of Mackinac in the Great Lakes. However, Unbridge has refused to shut the pipeline, asserting the Whitmer's order needs to be supported by a judge. The case is currently being heard in U.S. federal court, and the two parties started mediation in April. Canadian officials argue closing the pipeline would chuck off over half of the supply used to make gasoline, jet fuel, and home heating oil for the most populous parts of the country. Line 5 has been in operation for almost 70 years, but officials in Michigan have expressed concerns over its advanced stage. U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration data show the line has never leaked into the straits, but there have been at least eight other spills since 1980. The conflict has become the second such dispute since Biden became U.S. president in January, impeding the government's so-called efforts to work together to lower carbon emissions. The White House has so far been indifferent to Canadian entreaties, prompting Ottawa to contemplate more drastic options, including a threat to invoke an obscure bilateral treaty to keep Line 5 operating or intervene in the legal dispute currently playing out in the U.S. courts. The sources said that Canadian government officials are frustrated by the amount of time they are spending on the matter. According to spokesman for Canada's Natural Resources Minister, Seamus O'Regan, Ottawa has discussed the pipeline's fate in several bilateral meetings, including 23 vital meetings between lawmakers and U.S. members of Congress. Canada Environment Minister Jonathan Wilkinson told Reuters recently, "Clearly, Line 5 is an important issue for the Government of Canada. At the same time, we need to be advancing on a cooperative basis the work we are doing on climate action." Wilkinson brought up the issue during a meeting with U.S. climate envoy John Kerry on February 24th. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also raised the matter with Biden when the two met in February to discuss efforts to make global warming a joint priority. A source directly familiar with the matter said Trudeau's administration is considering whether to participate in the legal challenge by filing an amicus or friend of the court brief, which would clearly lay out their reasons for supporting Enbridge. Ottawa is also mulling over whether to invoke the never-before-used 1977 Transit Pipelines Treaty, designed to prevent U.S. or Canadian public officials from impeding the flow of oil in transit. Enbridge spokesman Ryan Duffy claimed the federal government continues to have a role to play, and we appreciate what they have done to date. This comes just 3 months after Biden angered the Canadian oil and gas industry by revoking the permit needed to finish the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, a years-long project that would have carried oil sands crude from Alberta, Canada, to the American Gulf Coast. Biden's action on his first day in office marked the second time a Democratic administration has scuttled the $8 billion project in less than a decade. Trudeau's government reluctantly accepted that decision, although it resulted in losses of thousands of construction jobs and further soured Ottawa's relationship with the key energy-producing province of Alberta.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
And we have not sent you, but as a mercy to the world.
I want to be a servant of God like Muhammad.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Muhammad, Rasulullah.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to this program, Like Muhammad, with me, Javed Akbari. We are going to discuss some important narrations and some important ahadith and sayings from our infallible imams and from the Ahlul Bayt about the etiquette of fasting or the adab of fasting sawm. One of the ahadith that has been reported and also found in the book Sunan al-Nabi, authored by Allama Tabatabai, is a report narrated from As-Sakuni from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, from his fathers, peace be upon them, that when the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, fasted and did not find any sweet to break his fast with, he would break his fast with water. Now, this report suggests that it is good, it is recommended, based on the prophetic sunnah and based on the prophet's lifestyle and etiquette, that one break his fast with something sweet like dates, okay? And dates are especially recommended for breaking fast. And nowadays we see that Muslims, of course, following the prophet's lifestyle, break their fast with dates. Now, if dates are not available, if dates are expensive to buy from the market, one can break his fast with something sweet, because if you use sweet to break your fast with, of course, a sweet thing actually suppresses the hunger, and it suppresses the appetite and causes one to eat less food. So it is generally speaking, it's recommended to break one's fast with something sweet, especially dates. It has also been reported in some narrations that the Prophet, peace be upon him, would sometimes break his fast with raisins. Raisins are also sweet, and of course, raisins are available and they are cheap and can be purchased from the market. Raisins are also good. Now, there is yet another hadith from Shaykh al-Mufid. Of course, Shaykh al-Mufid is also one of the early Muslim scholars and one of the early Shia scholars, because there are some important scholars who lived in the early period of Islam, like, for example, Kulayni, and, of course, the three Shaykh, like Shaykh Saduq, Shaykh Mufid, and Shaykh Tusi. And these are some of the very, very prominent Shia scholars who lived in the early period of Islam, close to the time of the last Imam or the last Hujjah, of course, the Imam of age. May Allah hasten his reappearance. These are the scholars who have written important books, like Kulayni. He's written his, for example, his Al-Kafi. Sheikh Saduq has written his Man La Yahzuruhu Al-Faqih. And Sheikh Tusi has also written his, for example, Tahdhib and Istibsar. These are some important books, of course, and some of the most authoritative and most important and reliable sources belonging to Shia, the religion of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salatu was-salam. When it comes to some of the reports narrated by Al-Mufid, Shaykh Al-Mufid, he has reported in his Al-Muqni'ah, narrated from the family of the Holy Prophet, it has been said that it is recommended to have suhoor. Suhoor means the meal served before dawn in the month of Ramadan, or even in any month, because if a person wants to observe fast, he has to have suhoor in order to have the strength and the capability to work during the day, to stay up, and to have the energy to walk. And of course, if a person does not eat the suhoor or the pre-dawn meal, then he is less likely to feel very much lazy and lethargic during the day. And that's why it is recommended to have the pre-dawn meal, which is the translation of suhoor. Now, the Prophet is used to serve something or to eat something before dawn. And even if it was only a glass of water, he would drink it. So that suggests that it's important to have something before dawn. Also, it is narrated that it is better to have dry dates. And of course, because this is what the Holy Prophet used to have in his suhoor. Okay. If dry dates are not available, then anything that is available should be used and should be eaten. It has also been reported from the Holy Prophet that he used to eat al-harisa. Al-harisa is an Arabic word which refers to a kind of, let's say, cereal food, food made of grains, and or maybe it's called bulgur and meat. So that's the food which is made from grains and meat. That food is very common in the Middle East, and the Prophet used to eat al-harisa more than any other food, and he would also have it for suhoor. Generally speaking, when it is in the month of Ramadan, and when the days are longer, or even when the days are shorter, it is important to have suhoor or the pre-dawn meal in order to have the energy necessary for doing a job or for staying awake. It has been reported in Al-Faqih. In Al-Faqih, man la yahdhuruhu Al-Faqih. Of course, man la yahdhuruhu Al-Faqih is one of the important authoritative sources written by Shaykh al-Saduq. It has been documented and recorded in Al-Faqih that when the month of Ramadan, for example, entered, the noble Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, freed all the prisoners and gave something to all the beggars. So I think the hadith and the narration is quite clear, and there's no need for explaining it. The Prophet, peace be upon him, released the prisoners and gave food to the beggars. He reached out to the beggars and tried to help as many beggars as he could. There are other narrations and reports which we will cover in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
a place where memories are all engraved in stone. Home, where we can plant an olive tree and call it our own. Where we can pray in peace under its golden dome. Home, a place where we can fly the flag of our beloved home. Fly the flag, if you believe in human rights. Fly the flag, if you believe in justice and freedom. Fly the flag, if you wanna cut through the darkest nights. Fly the flag, fly the flag for Palestine. Fly the flag, if you wanna tear down the wall of hate. Fly the flag, to see the fall of the Zionist state. Fly the flag, if you remember 1948. Fly the flag, fly the flag for Palestine. Men and women around the world, from Rachel Corrie to Soleimani, have sacrificed their lives for this land, to end its occupation and set it free. Until the dawn of victory, we've got to stand and not recline. Hand in hand we are stronger. Let's fly the flag for Palestine. Home, a place where every generation owns the key. Where we resist aggression and reclaim our dignity. Fly the flag, if you believe in human rights. Fly the flag, if you believe in justice and freedom. Fly the flag, if you wanna cut through the darkest nights. Fly the flag, fly the flag for Palestine. Fly the flag, tear down the wall of hate. Fly the flag, to see the fall of the Zionist state. Fly the flag, if you remember 1948. Fly the flag, fly the flag for Palestine. Fly the flag, fly the flag for Palestine. Fly the flag, fly the flag for Palestine. Fly the flag, flag for Palestine. Fly the flag, fly the flag for Palestine.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.